Good evening. We'll go ahead and get started on our third lesson on Age of the Earth in our apologetics class. I was out the last two Wednesdays, so you've had a couple weeks to marinate on the stuff that we've covered in the first two lessons. The first one looking at what's the biblical perspective on creation and Age of the Earth. Talked a lot about length of the days of creation, what the Bible's stance on that is. And then the second lesson, we looked at mainstream science's view of all that. Talked about radiometric dating and rock layers and a lot of the theory and perspective of the scientific community today. And, you know, a lot of the textbooks and professors and things that you'll hear when you go to museums and when you go to classes and things in school. Tonight, we're going to follow that up with challenges to mainstream science's view. So we're going to critique that a little bit. And then next week, we're going to look at, I think it's 11 different perspectives on Genesis 1, all of which somebody would say are biblically faithful views of Genesis 1. We'll kind of analyze that, and that'll kind of wrap up our look at Age of the Earth. You can take all that away and come up with what's your conclusion. So the first thing we're going to talk about tonight is apparent age. And I referenced an article from by Kyle Butt on apparent age. What is that concept? Yes.
Just because something looks like it is, it might not be. Like, he references that Adam and Eve, you know, are fully adults, you know, they look like they might be 20-somethings, but when in fact, you know, they're only a day old.
Yeah. So it's that concept that at the end of creation, we have things in place that are a few days old, but they're fully mature. The earth is here. It's fully mature. We have, you know, full-grown trees, probably. We have, obviously, Adam and Eve are able to walk around and talk and interact and things. And so, you know, that's something I hadn't thought of. I'll put it that way. So just because the earth may appear, you know, very, very old, it started out looking very, very old, probably in some respects. So if that's the case, then how does that affect how we interpret our observations of the physical makeup of the earth and how long it's been here? Angel?
Mm-hmm. The thing that I thought was interesting is they said, you know, people try to say that the earth is millions of years old, but how do you know what that looks like?
Yeah, and that was, you know, something they pointed out was, okay, you're going to look at the world and you're going to say, well, it just looks to be more than a few thousand years old. What are you basing that on? What's your baseline that you're comparing that to? Every measurement has a baseline, and I'd never thought of that, but it makes a lot of that make sense. And so that brings us to then recalibrating our conclusions about how old things are that we look around us and see. So you have this concept of apparent age. God creates the world, it's fully mature, and then we look at it today and we, you know, if you don't think too deeply into it, you think, well, it must look older than it is. Is God being deceptive in that? I see a few shakes, Ed.
Exactly what he did through his word.
Yeah, he told us what he did in Genesis 1. Flip over to Romans 1. I wanted to look at this too, because this came to mind. Romans 1, 18 through 25, I'll just go ahead and read it real quick. It says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over in the lust of their hearts to impurity so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. So God made himself known to us. One of the ways he did that was through his creation. He gave us evidence that there is a creator. Man sees that. What does man choose to do? What does man choose to worship? Yeah, he chose to worship the creature, the created things, ourself being one of those created things that we choose to worship in place of God. It talks about men professing to be wise. It said, we're wiser than that. We know better than that. And what's God's response? Yeah, he says, okay, you're going to be that way? Here you go. He gives us over to that and lets us, he gives us the rein, basically, to go that way. Not that he's not there making himself known, not that he's not there pleading us to acknowledge him, but he gives us a choice. And so that's what's going on when we look at the world today. Like, the evidence is there. Are we going to trust him and what he's told us about what he did, or come up with our own things? And that's one of the, when you look back throughout history, I think that's one of the most consistent things we see God saying to people is, trust me, not you, trust me. And so we have to decide, are we going to trust him regardless of how smart we think we are, regardless of how advanced our technology gets, regardless of, you know, what the textbooks and the museums and the experts say? But apparent age, this whole concept was something new to me, and it really, like, when I saw that, I was like, whoa, yeah, that makes some of this, you know, makes sense as far as why we see this and why we might automatically think, well, this has to be older than what it really is. Okay, anything else on apparent age? Yes?
If you look... You brought up the idea, you know, was God deceptive in the way that he described things? And what I would say is he's perfectly thorough. I mean, you look at planning a family vacation or a mission at war or a mechanical job somewhere, you're always going to miss something. I mean, something's not going to go right. Something's not going to be, you know, it's not going to happen the way you think it's going to happen. And this earth, we live on it, was perfectly designed for us. It's not the other way around. We didn't adapt to what was here. No, God perfectly made this world for you and I today.
Right.
The minerals in the ground and the things that we use in our lives, all those things were perfectly designed for us. That doesn't just happen by accident, is my point. So the idea that something just blew up out of thin air and created all this and it just worked out perfectly like it did, is ludicrous. Like, I mean, it's laughable that you would look at what we have and who we are, the way our bodies are made up, and you would say, yep, that was an accident. No one would say that in any other logical setting, you know, if you're having a logical conversation. But for some reason, when people get to the earth and our lives and the way things are set up, we're like, you know, some people are just, you know, I don't know how they get there. Well, that was just an accident. I mean, there's nothing on earth that points to an accident. It all points to, like, very, very logical, thought-out processes and you know, everything the way is, you know, everything is designed for us. It's just, it's hard to believe that someone would look at that and say that that's an accident.
Yeah.
Reference in Romans, right, the invisible attributes. It's the things we didn't understand years ago, right? If trees were this big and all the plants were tiny one day old, oxygen isn't there, right? I mean, with the whole photosynthesis and the processing of carbon dioxide and then the production of oxygen. None of it works unless it's created mature, right? The relative age, apparently the whole system.
Yeah.
And that's when I read invisible attributes, there's stuff we now figured out, but it's worked like that since the beginning. Invisible stuff that we don't know, but it had to be mature in order for it to work.
Yeah. And also, they might, you know, and we mentioned this in earlier classes, you know, how much is there that we just don't know and we'll never understand, just aren't capable of understanding that God's put in place?
You know, the problem with all of this is people are so focused and devote their entire lives to either prove or disprove creation, and they miss the entire point of the Bible. God's entire purpose for us is lost because we're focused on how did this happen here, and trying to gain knowledge, it's almost like we're in Babel, trying to be so smart that we understand and have the exact answer for everything instead of just saying, you know what? God created it. What does he want me to do with it?
Right.
And that's the whole part that just makes my head reel. It's just like, why would you waste your life missing the point? That's a good point.
Yeah, missing the forest for the trees. Yeah. Good. Anything else? Okay, so let's talk some more about radiometric dating and the assumptions that underlie that. We've mentioned this in our second lesson. Assumption one, we talked about how if you're going to date rocks, minerals, based on the presence of a certain number of parent isotopes and daughter isotopes, you've got to assume that that is a closed system, that you're not having parents come in or daughters escape or vice versa. Because if that's happening, you don't have any basis, you don't have anything to baseline that measurement on. And I cited an excerpt from an article, More Conflicting Evidence from Evolutionary Dating Techniques. That article had a lot of things in it. You kind of had to fish out the point about, you know, focused on this closed system assumption, but I've quoted it here, where basically there's evidence that there is an egress of parent isotopes and an ingress of daughter isotopes. What did they find, and what are the repercussions of that? What are the outcomes of that? Yeah, the longer time goes on, the more opportunity there is for this ingress and egress to occur. Ed, did you have your hand up?
I mean, it's been proved from what he wrote. This does occur, so therefore, you know, it's just wrong to say that it's not, you know, it's a closed system.
Yeah, they've got a situation where they've got a rock, and they're dating the mineral, and then they're dating these little deposits of carbonaceous material within them, and they're getting two different dates. They're saying, well, the carbon is older than the mineral it's embedded in. And so you've got a situation where either your radiometric dating is proving itself to not be accurate, or you are getting this transmission and passing of isotopes in and out of the mineral. So either way, you've got a problem with your radiometric dating. Anything else on that one? Mark?
Because that decay is an exponential thing, as you start getting down to really tiny amounts, any small change makes your end result, the error bar is huge on that, the further and further back you go. So the further back they're saying that date is, the larger the error is. Errors need to be.
Yeah, and I don't know enough about it. Like, one of the big questions in my mind is, how do we know we're even accurately measuring the number of isotopes within this sample anyway? I don't know enough about it to you know, question that too much, but that's one of the questions I have. But yeah, you're right. Angel?
Like they were talking about and what we looked at earlier, they assume that it's a closed system, and nothing in nature is a closed system. And they assume that it regresses at a steady rate.
Mm-hmm.
And with other factors that go in there, there's no way that that happens anywhere in nature unless God designed it.
Yeah, and that's a good segue into the
second assumption, that, which is radioactive decay rates have always been and are always now constant. From that article, from new findings show flaws in old Earth dating methods, what have they found about radioactive decay rates? Ed?
By solute layers, and the decay rate is slower and faster in winter and summer. And so, according to that article, it's just verifiably false to say that it's constant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're finding evidence that it does fluctuate with to some amount, at least,
seasonally with whatever's going on with the solar weather. So there is evidence there that there are fluctuations in it, and whether those have, you know, what that's looked like across the entire history of the Earth, nobody really knows. And then I listed the third assumption here. We actually know the half-life of radioactive isotopes. I didn't dig into that one much. I don't know much about that. I don't know if anybody else does, but that's, you know, one of the things that I wonder about too. How do we actually know the half-life of these isotopes?
Has ever been able to sit and observe all the way through the half-life of an unstable isotope? And at the same time, an unstable isotope can be charged with the right amount and direction of radiation, external radiation. We know that from radium. If you have something that's been painted in order to be able to see it at night with radium, if it starts to get dull, in other words, it starts approaching its half-life, all you got to do is put a bright light on it or put it out in the sun and it recharges.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that at least with that element, you can get recharging on your instability.
Okay. Anybody else on that one? It's more than I knew. Okay. Finding soft tissue in dinosaur remains. This is an interesting one, and David's brought it up in, you know, some of the apologetics things that he's presented, but the article, Dinosaur Soft Tissue is Here to Stay, you know, they're finding as they look at dinosaur remains, dinosaur fossils that they find, and they're finding what they call soft tissue, amino acids, proteins, flexible, you know, blood vessels and things that are still flexible, still pliable. Why is that notable?
Meat doesn't hang around a long time. Just make real basic about it. You know,
yeah.
It goes away after a while. Even if you freeze it, it quite often will deteriorate.
And how far back do a lot of scientists tell us dinosaurs went extinct?
Yeah, 65 million years. That's a long
time for some blood vessels and proteins to hang around. So if we're finding it in these fossils, what are the two kind of conclusions that come out of that? Either ors. What does that suggest? Okay, that's one of them. Either it wasn't 65 million years ago that dinosaurs went extinct, or
okay.
They dug up the
next door neighbor's dog.
Okay, I didn't think about that one. Or everything we know about decay rates is wrong. Everything that we can study, we can repeat, all that has given us false conclusions. It's one or the other. And I know which one I hang my hat on, but okay. Limitations of archaeology. This came from the article by Gary Brantley, Dating in Archaeology, Challenges to Biblical Credibility. What problems, what limitations are there in the practice of archaeology? Let's just talk about, list out some of those challenges, some of those limitations. David?
Evolutionary assumptions that, you know, viewing the data through evolution-colored glasses, you know, so everything, you're going to fit into that framework mentally.
Yeah. Okay. So we've got, a lot of times they're starting with an
evolutionary mindset. Ed?
And it's accurate because they're all based on assumptions, and the assumptions are based on evolution.
Okay. So, yeah,
he brings up that the dating methods they employ, they're imperfect. They're based on these assumptions, and we're finding flaws with those assumptions. Okay?
Method, it's like they said, there's various pottery being used by different people at the same time period. Mm-hmm. So to say this one's old over here, this was not, they might have been at the same time period.
Okay. It's not
imprecise. It can get us maybe within a ballpark, but it's not real precise. What else? Miss Debbie?
Problem just to find somebody who's willing to sponsor a dig, you know, and because they expect something back for their contribution to that too.
Okay.
That might influence or not influence, but you know.
So you're saying that might influence like the conclusions that they publish based on who's sponsoring?
And it wouldn't give you the opportunity to have as many people being dedicated to doing.
Okay.
Dig anything up.
Okay, that would definitely be a problem.
Ed?
Wherever you're involved in this and you really have this, you know, evolution is true, I'm going to prove it true. And I'm sure there's been a lot of people that have been involved in these digs or whatever like that to think about maybe how much data or information or discoveries that have been pushed under the carpet or, you know, just eliminated or ignored. It's probably a lot of information. I can only assume that. Seems like it's very possible.
Okay.
So bias causing people to hide evidence or misrepresent evidence.
How the evidence is tested to determine the date of it and how far back it goes. So maybe one scientist uses one technique and someone else uses another and they come to different conclusions, so it's not even that accurate.
Yeah, that would definitely cause you to question methods.
When, you know, in these archaeological digs, like even at a given site, how much evidence do they find? Are they able to piece together a year by year by year by year, here's what happened here?
A lot of what they find might be broken and burned and just kind of random elements, and they don't know what goes with what. Maybe it's all mixed from some other civilization. Who knows? So they're just doing the best they can to piece together what they find.
Yeah, they have a very limited amount of evidence that they're finding.
But like David said, they're doing the best they can, hopefully, to piece that together. But we need to make sure that they're being honest about how much they're finding and, hey, we're making this conclusion or these assumptions based on this limited amount that we found. It's not always presented that way. You don't always get that, hey, we had this limited amount of information and here's what we came up with out of that. Ed and then Mark.
Found a flint arrowhead and you took it home and put it in your house and they dig your house up 100 years from now. I guess they think you used flint arrowhead. That's what they said. A lot of this gets mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not that consistent necessarily.
Yeah.
Mark?
Something Jamie touched on in one of his previous lessons is sometimes with these finds, the original authors will write a paper that's very conservative in their findings. They're very specific. We found this, and their conclusions are very limited. But by the time that paper gets distilled down and reported another time, or maybe another time after that, in the popular science articles, the conclusions are much overblown from what the original author said.
Okay.
And so that story kind of gets changed, kind of like a game of telephone, over time, until by the time that people like us hear about it, it's significantly different from what the original authors even say that they found.
Mm-hmm. And that gets back to, you know, the things we were talking about as far as, maybe it's Jade that brought this up, you know,
scientists, when they're looking into something, if there's well-established, published studies on something that came to one conclusion, they don't necessarily go back and redo those studies to make sure that that person was right. They're saying, okay, we assume this was right, we're going to build on that. And so, like you're saying, if that wasn't right, then what you're building on may not be right. Somebody else have a hand up? Okay, so talked about operating on evolutionary assumptions. There's limited amounts of evidence. That, you know, is a good breeding ground for imaginative conclusions based on limited evidence, especially when you're vying for preeminence in your field and those types of things. Makes archaeology an imprecise science. It also, the article also talked about how, you know, archaeology, they're digging up artifacts, and there's not a lot there to tell you why something happened. Like, I can tell that this place burned, but without other things to put with that, I don't know why it burned, for example. And so they've got to fill in those whys with other evidence, and sometimes, you know, get creative with things rather than presenting that, hey, we don't really know why this happened, but this is what we're thinking. And then the final thing was just that archaeological interpretations, they're in a constant state of flux. We learn more things. Different people look at it and put it together with different things, and so the conclusions change across time. But I think one of the things that surprises me, you know, with all of this, with all the limitation to archaeology, when you walk in a museum or when you pick up a textbook, it's not presented that way. Like, we were up in Beavers Bend State Park last week, and they've got a little nature center at the check-in, you know, the ranger station or whatever, and they've got a little diorama museum there of supposedly the native history of that area. And the first little diorama is a painting of some woolly mammoths and these gorilla-looking people with spears, you know, running up and stabbing the woolly mammoth. And they're talking about how so many millions of years ago, these are the people that inhabited this place, and they were hunting woolly mammoths with spears and things, and they were primitive people and this and that. But there's nothing there about what that's based on and how limited the evidence is and all these different things. It's just, this is fact. Anything else on that? Archaeology. Ed?
Thanks to the dinosaur and the soft tissue.
Oh, yeah.
It would have to be well preserved too, and I know it's been commented lots of times. Well, this dinosaur died and he laid there in a field for millions of years. And if anybody's hunted and you shoot like a hog or something, and you leave it out in the field, it might not last till tomorrow. I mean, that's how that works, especially
right.
A soft tissue. I mean, the bones will probably be gone too, but. The soft tissue will definitely be gone. So to be preserved, it almost has to be buried.
Yeah.
Like in a flood with silt or or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. So that's just another point, I think, about what the soft tissue might prove.
Yeah. Okay. Obligative mutualism. What is that?
Or the functions within an organism.
Okay.
For example, the gut biome in most mammals is very important. You've got these bacteria living in intestines that are very important to mental and physical health of the host. If you go to Northern California, you look up way up in a sequoia tree, you'll see what looks like little brown warts all over the bark. That's where a woodpecker came along and pecked into the bark to get some insects, and then the squirrels came up and used those holes to store their food. So, you know, how did the one work without the other? I mean, it's a regular thing, and year after year after year, they do the same thing to survive. And there are a few examples in here as well, but there are some that are a lot more mutually exclusive, or inclusive, I guess you'd call it, to the exclusion of any other way to survive. Mm-hmm. The endocrine system in the human body, the one gland talks to another gland through hormone secretion, and they respond to each other, responding to stimulus from the brain to tell your body to do certain things in order to survive. If you lose just one element of that, you got to get medication to live another couple of weeks. If it all evolved, it had to evolve all at the same time.
Right.
And you got to wonder, at what point did the first photosynthesis product evolve? And how did it spread? How did it maintain itself? How did it come to maturity? You have things that depend on each other, and without that interdependence, it doesn't survive.
Right.
So what does that then suggest about, you know, we've been talking a lot about interpretation around the length of the days in the creation record. What does that suggest about the length of those days?
One organism didn't die out before the other one was created, right, or came to be,
right,
in order for them to be dependent of one another. Plants and bees were created on different days, but if those were millions of years, then there would be no flowers.
Right.
So if you didn't hear him, it suggests that the length of the days of creation were short enough that the yucca plant, for example, didn't die out before the yucca moth was created or came to be, so that it could go pollinate and so that the moth could keep going as well. Ed?
Just to think about, you always see this picture of evolution, you know, this monkey going, in, you know, to a man.
Uh-huh.
And he talks about mutually exclusive, I mean, or inclusive, whatever you want to call it. The male and the female would have to evolve simultaneously. Now, you talk about something that's totally impossible. And that means in every single species, the male and the female would simultaneously have to evolve. They can't just have one of them. The male, that's the picture you see. Here's this, now it's a man.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, you know.
I hadn't thought about that.
I need something else here besides just this man evolving. I mean, it's possible.
I didn't know about that. That's a good point.
I've got something really dumb to say. So I just want to warn everybody with that. All this talk about how things are so, they depend on one another. Things have to evolve at the same time and all this for all that to work out. The other day, I'm not making this up, I'm eating a can of mixed vegetables. I take my spoon of mixed vegetables, I get it out, there's a green bean standing on its end, and balanced on the top was a little piece of carrot. And I thought that was so cool. I said, Jin Lee, come here, look at this. I've never taken a spoon out of this and had a carrot balanced on a vertical piece of green bean. And I immediately thought of evolution. I thought, what are the chances that I'm 56 years old, I've never taken a spoonful of mixed vegetables and had a green bean stand straight up with a carrot balanced on top. And, you know, we talk about all this other stuff. And it just gives an idea of the foolishness of the idea that chance could cause all this stuff, when I'm amazed about a green bean. That's it.
Thank you, Brent. That's good. Yeah. Yeah, and it goes back to what Kyle was talking about. It makes you wonder. I mean, we understand intuitively that my car parked in the parking lot did not come together across a few million years and boom, fall in my driveway and I get in it every day. Like, we understand that was designed, that was built in a factory, that was, you know, somebody was behind that. So, anything else on anything we've covered tonight or even the other classes? We've got 3 minutes and that's it. Otherwise, I'll let you go. Joel.
About what Peter said in 2 Peter 3, where he talks about in the last days, folks are going to come scoffing. Where is the promise of his coming? In paraphrasing, things are now as they have been since the creation of the world. Mm-hmm. And I think we just need to prepare ourselves to be scoffed at when we espouse and voice our belief in what the Bible teaches. But Peter's point here is that the power of God's word is what brought it all into existence and then what destroyed it all in the flood. And by that same word, he's storing it all up for destruction in the future. And so that's the, again, just the takeaway that's been mentioned several times is that, you know, there is an all-powerful creator and he has a plan for us and we are obligated to obey him and respond to what is created, but then also what he's revealed to us in his word.
I think you touched on kind of two of the big things that I think studying apologetics is about. One, a genuine search for the truth. And then the other thing is, you know, as you look into these things, as you build these very, you know, stances on these very foundational elements of faith and your perspective on the world, it prepares you, I think, to go out and say, this is what I believe, this is why I believe, and, you know, be kind of armored against whatever their reaction is, if that's scoffing or whatever it is. I think that's important. Thanks. Anything else? Kaylin?
19, verse 29, which says, I have more insight than all my teachers through your testimonies or my meditation. So that verse just constantly makes me feel better that even though, like, you know, professors may be intimidating or these scientific articles you read may be intimidating, that we have more insight because we follow God's word. Yep. And I also appreciate that a lot of these things we're talking about, it's very scientific and there's science involved, but the word that's been used a lot also is logic, and it's very logical, and that just kind of has to do with common sense. And so it's encouraging to know that even though I may not know all the, you know, ins and outs of all the science, it's still, you can just bring it back to logic, and you can, you know, have confidence that you have more insight because you follow God, and he's all powerful.
Thanks. 1:20 says, wisdom shouts in the street, and talks about wisdom personified like a woman trying to get our attention. And all these points you're bringing out in these classes, to me, are God's wisdom shouting for our attention, whether it's the dinosaur bones or this obligative mutualism, all this, whatever, how it's pronounced. And it's like, you know, the more we discover, the more we see God's wisdom, whether it's the Yakamoth or whatever it is, it's all on display. And it's like, well, how do you explain that? And we just get more information, and it's just more and more wisdom shouting for our attention.
Yeah.
They don't call it faith.
But they're good at presenting it like they can back it up. I think that's what makes them so convincing. Yeah, you're right. All right, thanks. We'll pick it up next week with our last Age of the Earth lesson.